Okay, we're going to begin with an announcement about a summer program that UCLA has.
Hi guys, if you've heard me before, please ignore it. But if not, my name is Harpy. I work for AAP as a peer counselor. But what I'm about to share with you has nothing to do with peer counseling. I'm here to talk about the travel study that Poli Sci department has. There's two this year. Both of them go to Europe, but they're different countries. So if you're missing a couple of units, if you're a senior, don't want to do summer school here and want to reward yourself, please take a look at these programs. You can get up to two classes, which is 8 units, and you can sign up for an extra 199 course, which gives you a research paper option with one of the professors. The professors that I did it with was Lofty and O'Neill, and they're just absolutely amazing. There's another one that goes with Pagnon and Cisa, I believe. Please take a look, get a flyer, look on the website. She'll tell you all about the logistics, but I'm going to tell you about the fun. It was 4 weeks. All I did was see and learn and get acculturated to a whole new world. Trust me on this. You want to go. And I don't work for the travel office, so I'm not trying to sell anything. I just think it changes your whole view of the world. And I think that if you want to come back with 4,000 pictures of different things from all over Europe, like Big Ben, Red Line District, whatever you could, the Louvre, whatever you could think of, you're going to get have access to that. So I highly, highly recommend it. I think it's one of the most amazing opportunities we have as a student. And if you think it's expensive, she'll give you options of how you can pay for it. I highly recommend it. If you have questions, I will put my personal email. So this is not work related. If you want to come talk to me about what to take with you, how I signed up, what I did, all that good stuff, you can refer to me. If you have personal questions, as in like specifically for the website and how you go about specific to the travel study office, it would be to them. But if you want specific as in personal information, I'm more than willing to share. You can email me on my personal email or drop by Campbell Hall. I work in 1228 and I'm there almost every day, so just drop by and I'll give you a whole session of what I did. So please, if you have questions, let me know. And now I'm going to give it to Kristen to talk about the logistics.
Hi, I'm from the UCLA International Education Office.
Do you mind just please
if this really interests you, it's really easy to register. You basically go on our website, and then you sign up and click registration, fill out a quick form, and you pay a $300 deposit. Once you pay that $300, it secures your spot. So like you don't have to worry about it. You're on the program if you pay the $300. Also, if you're worried about paying the whole like the program fee, we have scholarships and financial aid available. Right now, one of our biggest scholarships just got extended till February 20th. So it covers the whole program fee if you get the scholarship. So I highly recommend that you look into it. And if you have any more questions, you can always visit our office in Murphy 1332. And I'll leave these flyers here for you guys to take.
Just remember, it's an amazing opportunity. It's not mandatory, but it's definitely something that you want to do. I have heard so many graduates said that they regret not doing travel study, and whoever has, I've never heard them say, oh, I hated it. It was the worst experience of my life. Even if you do nothing but go to class, you still walk to class, and by walking, you see so many amazing view, amazing architecture. Just, it's wonderful. If you have time, if you're a senior, junior, sophomore, it really doesn't matter. Try, come talk to me. I'll give you my pointers. I'll tell you how I can make it cheaper for you. And I can tell you what I did and what I didn't do and I wish I did. But definitely you won't regret this experience. And there's flyers in the
Okay.
Thank you
very much. Okay. The class on Friday, is this loud enough? Okay. The class on Friday was about America's entry into the Second World War, an absolutely decisive event in the history of the 20th century, pivotal event, certainly as far as this course is concerned, because it marked the end of one story and the beginning of another. As soon as America came in, the outcome of the war was certain. Hitler's fate was sealed. This was understood immediately at the time. Churchill, Winston Churchill, the great British leader at the time of the Second World War, his reaction when he heard of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, absolute delight. You know, he says, "So we had won after all," he remembers thinking. Being saturated and satiated with emotion and sensation, I went to bed and slept the sleep of the saved and the thankful. It's very clear what the outcome of the war is going to be. It's clear even in Hitler. Right? The end of one story, the beginning of another. What is the story that now begins? It's the story of the Cold War. The dominant political development of the second half of the 20th century. Why is the Cold War of interest to us? It's in a sense a fourth great conflict that we're covering in this course. We looked at the origins of the First World War, the origins of the European War of 1939, the origins of the Second World War, the war in the Pacific. And now, in the rest of the course, we're going to be focusing on the Cold War. Why is the Cold War important? Because it gives us some insight into the question of how international conflict is to be understood, what makes for war, but also, in this case, what makes for a stable international system. Because one of the most striking things about the Cold War is that it wasn't just a conflict, pure and simple. Right? It was a political system. The Cold War political system was the basis for a relatively stable, relatively peaceful international order, an order that more or less came into being by 1963. Right? So we're interested in the Cold War because it gives us insight into both sides of the coin. How is the conflict to be understood? How is it that a stable international system takes shape? So how do we go about getting a handle on all of these issues? Just plunging into the documents, looking at the evidence in a totally mindless way? No, that's never the way to kind of get insight into these fundamental questions. You always want to bring a theoretical perspective to bear. The theory enables you to see what the questions are, to bring the problems into focus. Right? Things which you just ordinarily would take as given, and this is the kind of thing that happens, a theory can help you see why they're puzzling. A theory is important, not because it gives you the answers, but because it gives you a handle on the questions and enables you to see what the questions are. In the case of the Cold War, people think, oh, there's nothing real to be explained here. You know, Soviet Union is a communist dictatorship. United States, liberal democracy. Obviously, there's going to be a conflict, you know. Cold War is obviously to be understood in ideological terms. And then you start thinking, no, that point of view, it just doesn't make any sense. It's like, I mean, this is very similar to the way we looked at the origins of the Second World War, especially the events of 1941. Why would Hitler go to war with the United States when the United States was so much stronger? Why would Japan go to war with the United States? Doesn't make any sense, right? From a theoretical point of view, if you think of international politics in purely ideological terms, you don't have this kind of problem. But why would Japan attack a country that was so much stronger? Well, you know, that's the question you ask when you've kind of grappled with these theoretical issues and developed a certain framework in your mind about how international politics works. The theory makes you see that things are puzzling. In this case, in the case of the Cold War, the same thing is true. It's like, oh yes, the United States, Soviet Union, very highly ideological countries, very strong ideologies. But that can't possibly explain the conflict. See, oh yeah, sure, the Soviets would have liked to communize all of Europe, take over all of Europe. Yeah, no question about that. But not if it meant a war with the United States. You know, the status quo of a divided Europe, with the Soviets controlling the areas their armies occupied at the end of the war. That kind of line that everyone knows that went right down the center of Europe, included like half of pre-war German territory in the Soviet sphere. You know, the maintenance of that system was vastly preferable to a war with the United States. And the Americans felt basically the same way. Yeah, sure, we would have loved to see a liberal democratic regime sprouting up all over Europe. But we weren't going to go to war with the Soviets in order to achieve that result. You know, this Cold War status quo, the division of Europe, you know, where we basically controlled the western part of the continent, the, you know, economically most important part of the continent, and therefore most important in terms of mobilizable war potential. You know, the maintenance of that Cold War status quo was vastly preferable to a Third World War. All right, so you see what the problem is. You see the problem of the Cold War here. It's like, well, if both sides felt that the division of Europe, the situation that it resulted from where the army stood at the end of the Second World War, where the eastern part of the continent was basically controlled by the Soviets and the western part by the United States and our friends, if both sides were willing to live with that and that situation was vastly preferable for both sides to a Third World War. Where was the problem? Why should you have, you know, this very serious political dispute, which at times seemed to, you know, carry within itself the seeds of a Third World War? You know, that the risk of a Third World War seemed very high at certain points. Sometimes it seemed, you know, this is like this terrible winter of 50-51, and then again during the Berlin and Cuban Missile Crisis period of like 61-62, it seemed like, you know, a Third World War was a real possibility. So that doesn't make sense, right? How is it to be understood? Well, that's the puzzle. That's the puzzle of the Cold War. And it's a puzzle that you flesh out by bringing international relations theory to bear. It's not something that you would tend to view excuse me, as puzzling if you approach these problems in a totally atheoretical way, right? So the theory is of value, not because it gives you the answers, but because it brings the questions into focus. And when you do the historical analysis with those theoretical problems in mind, the results you get will then further refine, further help you develop your own understanding of how international politics works, what's really important in driving the course of events, what kind of factors, you know, shape political outcomes. Right? So that's why we're going to be interested in the Cold War. Okay. And what is the point of the lecture today? It's going to help you solve that problem, you know, answer those questions, you know, make sense of something which is so puzzling. No, it's going to deepen the puzzle. Because the whole point of the lecture today was that in the course of the year 1945, both sides moved toward an overt acceptance of the division of Europe as the basis of the post-war international political order. That's the point. And that's the meaning of Potsdam and then the Moscow Conference in December of 1945. Okay, so what's the story here? For most of the war, you didn't have to worry about what the post-war system would be like. But it was only when the Soviet army started to move west toward Germany that these questions of the post-war system came into focus. Because to move to Berlin, they were going to have to cross through territory that had been Polish before the war. They would have to basically move across Poland. And thus the whole issue of the political fate of Poland became salient. It moved to the top of the political agenda as the Soviet armies moved into Polish territory in 1944. Poland, why was Poland important? Well, for the British, that was supposedly why they went to war in the first place, over the whole issue of Polish independence. And for the United States, well, it was important because the Americans believed that countries have the right to determine their own destinies as principles of self-determination. Plus, there is a large Polish-American community concentrated in key swing states in the Midwest, Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, states like that, that are kind of evenly divided between a democratic urban core and a more rural Republican base. So the how those states would vote when it came to a presidential election would be determined by these kind of swing factors. The Polish-American vote was quite important in determining political outcomes in America. So it mattered. The fate of Poland mattered. On the other hand, President Roosevelt, he was a realist, and he understood that the fact that Poland was occupied by the Soviet Union was bound to influence the future course of political developments. The Soviets had never liked the idea of a hostile Poland, if only because that made it very difficult for Soviet power to be brought to bear in influencing German policy. As long as there was this hostile Poland that kept the Soviets out, Poland with ties to the West, that could kind of trigger Western involvement in the event that the Soviets moved toward Poland, Germany was insulated from Soviet power, right? So there was this basic kind of problem there having to do with the fate of Poland. And it seemed like the Soviets were determined to make sure that Poland would not be a hostile power in the post-war period, which meant that given the attitudes of the Poles toward not just the Soviet Union, but Russia more generally, what that meant was that the Soviets would have to control Poland, and that meant imposing a communist regime on Poland because a communist regime would be subservient to the Soviet Union. And it certainly seemed like the Soviets were moving in that direction. Instead, they broke relations with the exile Polish government in London, the heir of the pre-war Polish state, and instead set about creating their own Polish government, situating it in one of the first major town that they liberated from the Nazis. This was called Lublin. So this was the kind of Lublin government. And the Americans and the British were a little upset that the Soviets were proceeding in what they viewed as a fairly high-handed way, although, to tell you tell the truth, the Americans did exactly the same sort of thing in the areas that that they liberated, mostly it would be Italy in 1943, where the Soviets were not allowed to have any say in what went on politically in Italy, as Italy was liberated or conquered, however you want to put it, during the war. Right? What was the fate of Poland to be? Roosevelt wanted Poland to be in the Soviet sphere in terms of foreign and military policy. He accepted that as a reality, and not as a terribly objectionable reality either, but felt like the Poles should have internal autonomy, that they should be allowed to at least determine their own fate internally. Okay? This is the great American dream for the entire Cold War period. There was no thought of ejecting Soviet power completely from the eastern half of Europe. But we wanted to kind of combine that, Soviets having Eastern Europe as their sphere of influence in terms of foreign and military policy, but in terms of domestic political setup, we wanted the East Europeans to have a large degree of autonomy, to have, you know, whatever sort of political regime that they wanted to create. In other words, the sort of situation that developed in Finland after the war, where Finland was basically had to kind of toe the line in terms of foreign policy and subservient to the Soviets in that area, but in internal terms, Finland was allowed to be free and democratic. And, and in a sense, what you could say is the United States, what they really wanted for most of the Cold War period was a Finlandization of Eastern Europe. Okay, that's the great American dream. But the Soviets didn't see things that way. For them, control meant the imposition of communist regimes. Could that process be halted? It was very, you know, it was important to at least make the effort, an effort to halt it. And Roosevelt, although he was dying in beginning of 1945 and would eventually die in office in April. He was suffering from congestive heart failure. He was willing to travel halfway around the world to the Soviet town of Yalta in the Crimean Peninsula to kind of meet with Stalin and with Churchill as well and try and sort out this Polish business. This whole question of the fate of Poland, this lies at the core of international politics in early 1945. The Yalta Conference was essentially about Poland. And what did the Yalta Conference decide? This big myth. At Yalta, it was decided that Europe would be divided. Right? That's not true. If there's a spheres of influence conference at the end of the war, it's not Yalta, it's Potsdam, or even more, Moscow. Okay. What was decided at Yalta? That there would be a provisional government in Poland, that it would be based on the communist Lublin government, which since had moved into Warsaw. But the Lublin government would be broadened by the addition of additional democratic elements from the anti-Nazi resistance both within Poland and abroad, meaning the London Poles. Okay. That was the provisional government. The provisional government would hold free and unfettered elections, democratic elections, and out of those democratic elections, a new Polish government would emerge. Okay? Stalin agreed to all of this. Right? Americans, the British, including all of these career diplomats, hard-headed people, they were delighted. They felt that they had gotten a whole lot more from Stalin than they had thought they would. They came away from Poland, from Yalta, quite pleased with what they had gotten for the Poles. Problem was that Stalin had no intention of holding free elections in Poland and allowing an anti-communist, truly independent Polish state to emerge. Right? And this created a certain clash between him and his Western allies. Churchill was very much exercised over what was going on in Poland. And Roosevelt himself, his dying days, right, had kind of basically come to support a hard line on the Polish issue. You know, the settlement has to be, as it was envisaged at Yalta, not this, simply having a lightly disguised communist regime imposed on that country. Okay? Roosevelt dies in April. Truman comes to power, Harry Truman. Doesn't know much about any of these things. And his first reaction is, the Soviets are reneging on the deal that they had made with us. And that's intolerable. He meets with the Soviet foreign minister, Molotov, who's passing through Washington on his way to San Francisco for the conference that was, you know, supposed to adopt the UN Charter. And he meets with Truman, and this is in April, very soon after Roosevelt's death. And this whole issue comes up. And Truman says, look, you guys better keep your agreements. This is the way he reports it in his memoirs. And Molotov says, you know, I've never been talked to that way. And Truman wags his finger at him and he says, well, you keep your agreements and you won't get talked to like that. It seemed like, well, that's the Cold War, right? But in fact, the American attitude changes very quickly. Truman learns a bit that more about Yalta, that it wasn't quite as straightforward as he had made out. He wants to salvage the relationship with the Soviet Union because the whole prospect of a hostile U.S.-Soviet relationship he does not view with equanimity at all. And he sends Roosevelt's confidant, Harry Hopkins, over to Moscow. And Hopkins himself is dying at this point. Over to Moscow to see if he could work things out with Stalin. And they do come up with a deal, which was tantamount to kind of papering over the what the Soviets were doing in terms of imposing a communist regime on Poland. The Hopkins mission in May of 1945 marks the U.S. acceptance of Soviets having, for all intents and purposes, a free hand in Poland. And when Truman and Stalin and Churchill meet on German territory in late July, Germany capitulates in May, the war with Japan is still going on. They meet at Potsdam outside Berlin in late July, it continues through early August. The whole issue of Poland doesn't come up. The whole issue of, you know, you're not keeping your agreements about Poland, it's a non-issue. Poland had been settled. Okay? The Americans accept Poland as lying fully within the Soviet sphere. And you might think that if we accept Soviet domination of Poland, we're not going to object. They're imposing their control over any of these other countries in Eastern Europe, like Bulgaria and Romania. You know, Romania had been allied with the Nazis during the war. Romanian troops had fought beside the Nazis against the Soviets. You might think, well, after Potsdam, there shouldn't have been any problem. Right? The story of Eastern Europe is a little bit more complicated. I'll return to it in a minute. But for the time being, it seemed to the Soviets that they had gotten from their Western allies basically the green light to do what they wanted in the areas their armies controlled in Eastern Europe. Okay? The real issue at Potsdam, the central issue at Potsdam, was the German question, where Poland had been the focus at Yalta. At Potsdam, the focus was on Germany. What would happen with Germany? And the key to understanding American policy is to understand the thinking of the real maker of American policy, who is not Truman. Truman was relatively removed from these issues. But rather, Secretary of State Burns, who a major American political figure, by the way. In those days, the law of succession in the United States was if the president died in office, he'd be succeeded by the vice president, and then he would be succeeded by the Secretary of State. And since there was no vice president after Truman had become president, the Secretary of State would become the successor president. So it was important to have a major figure as Secretary of State, and Burns was very important in American politics at that time. What was American policy on the German question under Roosevelt? Basically, to kick the ball down the road. We don't want to think about it now. We don't want to have to deal with it until it's absolutely necessary. Why was this just an oversight? No. It was because the problem itself was so difficult. What should you do with the Germans? You know, put yourself in the shoes of people during the war, having to think about these kind of post-war problems. You know, Germans have committed all these, you know, horrific crimes. how should they be treated after the war? I mean, kept down forever, run as a colony forever? You know, as soon as they get out of line, do they just bomb them from the air? I mean, Roosevelt was kind of, at times, was thinking along those lines. You know, how long could you keep that up? Was that the basis for a stable system? Maybe you had to think in terms of eventually reaching some accommodation with these people. And so, but the whole idea of a soft peace, of a peace that looked toward reintegrating Germany into the international order, you know, this seemed entirely inappropriate in view of these enormous crimes that the Germans had committed. On the course website for this week, I put this song there by the you know, famous British songwriter Noel Coward, called "Don't Let's Be Beastly to the Germans." I think he wrote it in like 1943. He was like making fun of the whole idea that one could even contemplate a soft peace, a mild peace toward Germany. So they've been a little naughty to the Poles and Czechs and Dutch. I don't suppose those countries really minded very much. You know, just ridiculing the whole notion that Germany should be treated in a fairly gentle way. So a harsh peace, that wouldn't lead to a stable international order. A soft peace seemed entirely inappropriate. What are you going to do? How are you going to deal with the Germans? Best not to concern yourself with these issues until you absolutely had to. In the meantime, you should concern yourself with the immediate problem, which is that your army's advancing on German territory. You want to kind of divide up Germany into these different zones of occupation, the Soviets, the Americans, the British, and then actually even the French getting a zone of occupation in Germany. And the notion was that, well, there wouldn't be a German government, but instead authority would be vested in the zonal commanders. And if they wanted to, if they could act as a block and adopt policies that were for Germany as a whole, but if they failed to reach agreement there, then each of the zonal commanders would have the final say. All right, so that's the basic American policy. For practical purposes, Germany is going to be divided up into these zones. Okay, kicking the ball down the road. It's important because the Americans are not contemplating setting up a German government. They're not contemplating a rapid shift from the occupation into a post-occupation regime, meaning that the occupation is going to continue. If there's not going to be a German government, the occupation is going to continue, meaning, among other things, that American troops are going to be going to stay in Europe. They're going to stay in their zone in Germany. Well, that's an event. That's a decision of fundamental political importance. You just compare it with the decision that was made at the end of World War I to pull all the American troops out of Europe. Because as long as the American troops are in there, there's going to be a counterweight to Soviet power. It doesn't matter all that much how large that force is. Even a small occupation force that's incapable of withstanding a Soviet onslaught would trigger an American involvement in a war with Russia. So Russia is going to think twice before she tries anything of that sort. American power could serve as a counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. The mere fact that American troops are going to be there is going to keep the Soviets from gobbling up all of Europe. And Americans do think in these power political terms. We didn't want the Germans to control over Europe, and we don't want the Soviets to control over Europe. Okay? Is that a policy? Well, a policy is really worked out during the Potsdam Conference as U.S. leaders were forced to kind of face certain fundamental issues about their relationship with the Soviet Union, how Germany would be run, and so on. The Americans had been willing in the final analysis to accept what the Soviets were doing in Poland, But this didn't mean that their whole experience with Russia on the Polish question had no political effect. What it suggested to people like Burns is that there's no real basis for long-term cooperation between the United States and the Soviet Union. Yeah, how do we get along with them? We can get along with them by pulling apart. You know, they're going to control things in the part of Europe their armies occupy anyway. Okay? We can live with that. In exchange for that, we want them to accept the status quo in Western Europe. We want them to look on Western Europe as a Western sphere of influence, where America and her friends would call the shots. And this basic approach applied also to Germany. Let them control the part of Germany their armies occupy, the eastern part of Germany. We and our friends will control the western part of Germany. On that basis, we can get along with them. That's much better than trying to run Germany together with them on a cooperative basis, because if we try and do that, it's going to lead to endless quarrels, endless squabbling. That's not good for our relationship with them. Much better to have kind of a clean separation. I call it an amicable divorce. You know, on that basis, we and they can get along with each other forever. Right? This, and how does this basic policy come into being? It comes into being as Burns especially grapples with the kind of central issue at Potsdam, which is the issue of German reparations. You know, this issue of German reparations, very important in the post-World War I period, also very important in the post-World War II period. Okay. What's going on with the reparations? Well, the Soviets, they're just carting off whatever they want to from the part of Germany they control. Part of Germany their armies occupy, Eastern Germany, you know? No limit in terms of these factories that they're dismantling and then shipping back to the Soviet Union. Okay. The Americans say, we can't have a reparation policy for Germany as a whole when the Soviets are doing this sort of thing. You know, again, endless squabbling over how these removals are to be valued, whether they're to be charged a reparation account or treated as war booty or whatever. Truman says the Soviets are naturally looters, but given what the Germans did to them, we can't blame them for that. What they're doing in Eastern Germany, well, I can live with that, you know? He says, it looks like we're going to be faced with a Slav Europe for a long time to come. I don't think it's so bad. Soviet-dominated Central Europe, not so bad. This is what Truman says at Potsdam. But Truman versus they're American nationalists. Soviets, they're going to do this stuff. Fine, we could live with it. But we are not going to basically finance what they're doing. The consequences of what they're doing. Because if you run Germany as a unit, the more the Soviets pull out of Eastern Germany, the greater the deficit would be that would be have to be financed by the Allied powers as a whole. And in particular, America would have to pay, you know, her share of the cost of financing the deficit, you know, because the Germans couldn't be allowed to starve. You had to import all this food and raw materials into Germany. If that deficit widened, who's going to pay for it, right? Well, the Americans would have to pay a large part of it if Germany were run as a unit. The Soviets would increase that deficit by stripping East Germany of everything that moved, more or less. And in effect, if America would have to pay for the a big chunk of the deficit that resulted from that, we would in effect be paying Germany's reparations for her. We don't want to do it. We don't want to get our skirts dirty, Truman says. You know, let the Soviets do it. You know, it's understandable. We might not like it, but it's understandable. But we are not going to foot the bill for it. Right? So they have, that's American policy. But, you know, the other side of that coin is that the Soviets shouldn't have to worry about what we and our friends are doing in Western Germany. They shouldn't have to worry about financing the deficit in Western Germany. This conception about the reparations foreshadows a basic political decision, which is to accept a division of Germany between East and West. What's the logic here? Well, Burns presents a plan based on these principles to the Soviets. The basic idea is you'll have a free hand to do whatever you want in terms of extracting reparations from the zone that you occupy, and we and our friends will have the same free hand to do what we want in this part of Germany we occupy, right? That applies to the reparations. The implication of that is that Germany, for purposes of foreign trade, is not to be run as a unit, right? Because how can Germany be run as a unit if the Soviets are going to have a free hand to extract all these reparations from their part of Germany without limit, right? It would mean that, as I said, the deficit, all German deficit would increase, and America would have to finance part of that. We're not having any part of that sort of arrangement. So instead, Germany's foreign trade is going to have to be run as a zonal basis. On a zonal basis, the Soviets would have to finance any deficit that their zone runs, whereas for the West, imports and exports into those zones, that would be the concern of the Western powers, right? So the zonal system for the reparations leads to a division of Germany between East and West for purposes of foreign trade. And I say the notion is that Germany is going to be divided not into four parts, where all the zones are going to be totally independent of each other, but two parts, because the assumption is that the three Western powers, and this includes the French, who aren't even represented at Potsdam, by the way, the three Western powers will have no trouble working out some sort of arrangement among themselves for running Western Germany by themselves. Okay? And when you're talking about dividing Germany between East and West for purposes of foreign trade, well, that means in overall economic terms, Germany can't be run as a unit, because Germany can't be run as a unit with trade going back and forth between the different parts of Germany if the two parts of Germany are going to have to relate to each other as foreign countries for purposes of international trade, or actually international barter, right? And when you're talking about dividing Germany between East and West, economically, well, that foreshadows a political division of Germany, because you're going to need administrative structures run by political authorities to manage all these different areas of the economy. And everyone understands this at the time. It's understood that the implication of the Burns plan is that Germany would be divided. And this is rounded out by certain other features of the Potsdam Agreement. That it's not simply you do what you want, we do what we want, but in fact, we're willing to kind of give the Soviets a little bit more than what they would get simply from their own zone. We're willing to allow them a certain share of the, you know, plant and equipment in Western Germany that was considered surplus from the standpoint of the post-war economic treatment of Germany. Okay. Big chunk of this is going to go to the Soviets free and clear. Another big chunk, the rest of it, is going to be sent east in exchange for food and raw materials from the east. Again, a concept which is predicated on the notion that Germany is not being run as a unit, but rather is being viewed as two separate entities that relate to each other as though they were foreign countries, right? Everyone understands the political implications. Stalin, in fact, takes the lead in extending the basic philosophy of the Burns Plan to include the divvying up of Germany's foreign assets. The clear implication of all this is that Germany is going to be divided between East and West, and on that basis, the two sides can get along with each other. Okay? So then what happens? It seems that the two sides had reached a fundamental understanding. How then can you get the Cold War? Well, Truman wasn't all that clear about how Bulgaria and Romania would be treated. At times it seemed like he was unwilling to recognize the communist regimes there. Local American authorities in the scene kind of encouraged the anti-communist resistance. This led to these problems between East and West in September of 1945. But by December 1945, they're all cleared up. This is the Moscow Conference of December 1945, basically between Burns and Stalin. And here the Americans accept, even more clearly than at the time of the Hopkins mission, the idea that Bulgaria and Romania, implicitly Eastern Europe as a whole, would be a Soviet sphere of influence. The Soviets would have a free hand in that area. They could set up communist regimes to control those areas. We don't object. An act of appeasement? No, because we're getting a lot from the Soviets in exchange. They're accepting the Western domination of the rest of Europe. They're accepting the fact that we're going to call the shots, not just in Western Germany, Italy, Greece, and so on, but in a sense, perhaps even more importantly, in Japan. They accept that America will have total control in the occupation of Japan, that Japan will be part of the U.S. sphere of influence. Very clearly a part of the deal that was struck in late 1945. What does this mean in terms of the questions that we're concerned with in this class? America, Russia, they had arrived at a certain understanding about what the post-war political system is going to be. The Soviets control the areas they occupy. We control the areas our armies occupy, both in Europe and in Japan. It's fairly explicit what's going on. You would think, therefore, that this would have led to a perfectly stable international order. Everyone accepts the post-war status quo. Where's the problem, right? Where's the problem? And yet we know that there was a problem. Because just a few months later, the Cold War begins. In the sense of America and Russia kind of, complaining about each other, hurling all these charges against each other, blaming each other for this and that. So much so that people in early 1946 are starting to think, maybe a Third World War is just a question of time. Maybe a Third World War is not out of the question by any means, right? What went wrong? How is that to be explained? It's profoundly puzzling once you look at the historical evidence. Right? It's not like, oh, the Cold War is perfectly natural. It's exactly what you would expect given the ideological differences. The ideological differences weren't strong enough to prevent Burns and Stalin from reaching an understanding by the end of 1945. So what happened? Right? That question has to lie at the heart of the analysis of the early Cold War period. Right? It has to serve as I don't know, like a chemical stain that you spread on a biological specimen that throws into relief the sorts of things that you're interested in. Right? It serves to focus our attention on what was, in fact, causing this problem that led to the Cold War. So let me just end with that point, and that's where I'm going to kind of pick up the story of 1946 next time.